Hey, thanks for tuning in to this special edition of the Spartan Pro Show. What you're listening to today is a live webinar we recorded with Alex Sheen of Because I Said I Would. During the presentation, he refers to a number of pictures that he has that he's presenting, which obviously you can't see because you're listening to this. So if you want to see the full thing, you can head over to our YouTube channel, Spartan Pro Show YouTube channel. But otherwise, if he makes references to images, that's why he's doing it. Thank you for tuning in to the Spartan Pro Show. Hello and welcome to the Spartan Pro Show, where we help you as a leader in your business or organization grow personally, grow professionally, and grow your business. No matter how your role is defined by your organization, you are a leader. I'm David Lillards, president of Spartan Branding, and my co-host is David Childs, the chief listener at Spartan Planning.
Honor your word. We are virtually sitting here with Alex Sheen, founder of Because I Said I Would, which is a social movement, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the betterment of humanity through promises made and kept, a movement seeking to change the world. Alex once walked 240 miles across Ohio to fulfill a promise that he made in 10 days. He has inspired millions of people around the world. He's been on national television, spoken at TEDx talks, and national industry conferences because he has continued to honor his word and serve those who are in most need. It's my honor to welcome Alex Sheen.
Hey, everyone. How's it going? Good to have this moment with you. Just got to get something out of the way. I think I've got like a, a little mullet started here. I've started combing it, which in this like sort of like Charlie's Angels type of way that it's a little bit creepy. Anyways, I hope everyone is doing as well as they can given the conditions. You know, when we think about everything that we're going through right now, healthcare is such a huge part of the formula to get everyone better. It's things that's everybody on everybody's mind. And when I think of healthcare, I automatically first person I think about is my dad. Pictured here, my father was a pharmacist in a hospital for 25 years. And in that work, you know, he had to run some long shifts. He had to work on holidays. And that was something our family just accepted. But he had this sort of work, this like mythical work ethic that is really highlighted by a story that he would always share about me as a little kid. Like anytime I had a new girlfriend in high school or something like that, like he just, I don't know, chopping at the bit to tell this story. And now I have to tell it to you. Okay, so this is a picture of my brother on the left here, who's wearing a, you know, his very fake smile. He was never good at that, but that's a nice little jean jacket he's got there in the early 90s. And then here on the right, I'm missing a couple teeth. But this story that my dad would always tell would take place around when I was about 5 years old, 6 years old, something like that. Okay, so it's about 1990. It's a Saturday morning. We're sitting at our house. My dad's at the kitchen table. He is drinking his morning coffee, smoking his morning cigarette back then in a robe or something, I don't know. And I'm running around the house, right? And for parents that might be listening right now, you could maybe sympathize with that stir craziness that we're feeling right now. So I'm doing some sort of version like that, just running around. And in this like angry Asian dad tone that he possessed so well, my dad goes, "Hey, Alex, come over here." And automatically I know I'm in trouble, right? So I'm like 5 years old. I walk over and I say, "Yes, Dad." And he goes, "Alex, you know, I work so hard at the hospital. I buy you all these things, all these toys, and you look at your room. Your room's an absolute mess. You're going to go clean your room right now," my dad says. But then he says, "Here's the deal, though. If you clean your room, I'm going to give you 50 cents. And so I don't say a word, right? I don't say a word. I just turn around. I walk up the stairs, run down the hallway, go to my room. Now, my room is right above the kitchen table where he's sitting, right? And he can hear my little feet pitter-patter around, moving things around. And in a unit of time that clearly is not enough to clean your room, I come back down the hallway, down the stairs. I come over to him. I throw 2 quarters on the kitchen table, and I say, "You do it," which is pretty gangster for a 5-year-old. And as much as my dad, you know, appreciated the cleverness of it, I'm pretty sure he was upset. But my dad loved that story because I think it highlighted a characteristic in me that he was trying to work out, which means, you know, Alex, you can't always just buy your way out of things. Sometimes hard work is the only way to get things done. And that's what my father was. He was a hard worker. My father, in many ways, that defined him. But he was average. I mean, he didn't write books. He didn't run marathons, you know. My father was just a pharmacist, you know. But there was one thing that did define him in that hard work, and that was keeping promises. My father was far from a perfect person, but he kept his promises. And it turns out when it comes to keeping promises, well, it seems like a lot of people don't do that anymore. And so one day, my father, this sort of dweeby pharmacist guy, you know, he's sitting at home. It's 2011, and here's his phone ring. So he turns it over, and it's a hospital calling. Well, of course, you know, he's got to answer. It's work. So he swipes, he answers, and on the other line is a doctor, a friend of his that he works with at the hospital. And in this phone conversation, my father is informed that he has been diagnosed with stage 4 small cell lung cancer. Now, my father, he was a go down swinging kind of man. You know, he came to this country as an immigrant, and I say that only because sometimes, you know, it's not so easy making it on your own. You had to develop some pretty tough skin to get by. And so with this attitude throughout his life, at this point of this diagnosis to this lung disease, my father elected for the most aggressive treatment, for radiation and chemotherapy. Now, a lot of people have obviously heard this phrase before, you know, chemotherapy. But not many people know what it actually is. You see, chemotherapy, it is quite literally a poison. It was developed prior to World War II and is based on a primitive concept. You see, cancer, it is so difficult to defeat. The thought was just to poison the body so deeply that the cancer simply cannot live in its conditions. And as extreme as that may sound, sometimes life doesn't give us choices. Sometimes that's the only way to give the patient a chance. But remember something for a second. You know, my father was a pharmacist in a hospital for 25 years. He knew more about the drugs he was taking than a lot of people ever will. And with that comes a distinct knowledge, a scientific understanding of the odds that are against you. And in the case of my father, those odds were terrible. But sometimes we got to go down swinging, right? And so my father, he took this treatment, this medication. And it actually started to work. This cancer that grew so close to his heart that it was surgically inoperable, couldn't be removed. It began to shrink, though, so small that you couldn't see it on any of these medical scans they kept doing on my dad over and over and over again. And even him, the most genuine of skeptics, I assure you, he deemed it some sort of miracle that perhaps he was saved. And so I felt like we had to celebrate, right? I mean, I went to college. I know how to celebrate, right? So I go to my old man. I said, "Dad, anything you want, anywhere you want to go. Money is no object. We got to celebrate this moment. This is incredible news for your health. Okay, let's hear it, Dad. Where do you want to go? What do you want to do?" What does he say? He says, I want Chinese food. Same Chinese restaurant every single time. He was super boring like that. You know how dads are. They got their routine. They like what they like. And so whatever. We go to the same Chinese restaurant we've been to like 7 trillion times. And it was a good day. You know, amidst COVID-19, you hear positive stories about recovery. And for a different disease of the lungs, I was a part of that. A good day. The kind of day that I obviously think a lot about. And the kind of day that I'll never have another one of. Because as you've probably already noticed, I speak of my father in the past tense. You see, the cancer would return to his lungs. It would spread into his pancreas, into his liver, into his brain. On September 4th of 2012, it was a bright morning. In the house that I grew up in as a child, as a grown man, I would go to my father's bedside and I'd play some music for him that I thought he might like. I held his hand. I told him that he did the best he could to take care of me and my brother and that we could take it from here. I desperately tried to comfort my father as I said goodbye for the last time. Now, you and I, we are only strangers. And I do not know if you've ever lost someone that you have loved. I can only say that I have. Okay, his name was Al Sheen. He had 2 sons. I'm one of them. He put a roof over my head. He paid for me to go to college. I was named after him. And in the course of all of our losses, we have so many questions. Like, why him and why now? Why does it have to be me and my family? And in this struggle, we are afforded very few answers. In my struggle, I was asked by my family to give my father's eulogy, to speak to his greatest characteristic, his greatest quality as a man. I kept coming back to this thought, the importance of a promise. You see, too often in this life, we lose track of our priorities. Too often in this life, people say things like, I'll get to it, or tomorrow. Well, the last thing that my father taught me is that one day there will be no tomorrow. And the promises that we make and we keep and those we choose to dishonor, that is what defines us and our character. It always has. Long before my father was ever born and long after I go, it is a single measure of honor. One that we use so quickly to judge other people, right? How they treat their commitments. But perhaps as quickly we should use this to judge ourselves. I would give my father's eulogy and the title of this speech would be because I said I would. I would talk about the importance of a promise and for the very first time that day, I would hand out one of these. I called it a promise card. On the front, it says, because I said I would. On the back, there is nothing else. It is very simple to use. What you do is you take a promise in your life. Maybe it's something small that you said today, or maybe it's something so deep that it defines part of your purpose for even being on this earth. You write that promise on this card. You go to the person you're making that commitment to. You tell them, I'm going to fulfill this promise. And when I do, I earn this card back. This card is a symbol of my honor, my respect. It is my property, and I'm coming back for it. You go, you fulfill your promise. You come back to that person. You earn your card back, and you keep it as a reminder that perhaps you are a person of your word. Maybe someone like Al Sheen was to his boys. And so his funeral ends, and I go home. And the next thing I would do would set off a chain of events to the scope of which I may never understand. That's where this darn internet comes in, I guess. You see, I'd make this post online, an offer. I said that I would mail, like physically mail. I said that I would mail 10 promise cards to anybody, anywhere in the world at no cost to anyone, which is the dumbest financial decision I've ever made in my entire life. First lesson today, don't offer free stuff to strangers on the internet. That should go without saying, but I'm not that bright. See, this is a picture of the first five sets of cards I ever sent out. Five requests in a day is no big deal. You wake up early, go to sleep a little late, a few here and there. It's not a hassle. But that's five requests in a day. What if you were to receive, 50 requests in a day or 500? Or one morning you wake up and that little red notification bubble on your phone, it says 15,000? What do you do then? Well, I would have to figure that out. And that is because since September 4th, 2012, the day that my father left, we have distributed over 9.81 million promise cards to over 153 countries around the world and by request only. 153 countries. You see, it turns out it doesn't matter what language you speak. It doesn't matter the color of your skin, how much money you make, how old you are, or who you love. We all understand the importance of our promise. So that's why I want to hear from you. In the live chat right now, I would love to hear your thoughts on what a promise has meant to your life. Maybe this. Who's been the most reliable person in your life? I think that's a question that if we reflect on, we can quickly see that promises were part of that equation. But this card, this thought of a promise, it's something that has taught me so much, not just because of where it came from in the loss of my father, but actually because of humanity itself. I would learn what I know about promises because of people like you that would write promises and share with us on social media. And maybe that's a commitment to someone who's close to you, right? Like to a family member. Like this young girl writes, "I promise to make life worth living for my sister with Down syndrome every day of her life and to take care of her when my parents are no longer able to." Maybe a promise is in recognition of a simple fact. Like this young man in the Czech Republic. I mean, he is certain that somebody somewhere has got to need that half liter of blood more than he does. And so he commits to helping the sick or the injured. One pint of blood can save up to three lives. Did you know that? Or maybe it's just a random act of kindness. 14-year-old girl in Brunswick, Ohio writes, "I will sit and make friends with the kids who sit alone at lunch." Because she realizes that we make promises all day long, maybe these small things, and because they're small to us, we just kind of forget about them. But to that other person, something that's small to you could be the entire earth. And in other cases, I don't have to go into some kind of deep background story. You see the picture, you read the words, and you understand what a promise might mean to a family or to our country. This card would be used in ways I could never imagine. I could never forecast. And even to this day, to this very moment, as our cause has spread around the world, we see promises that make a difference in the fight against even COVID-19. This is a picture of Miranda. She owns a small bridal shop near Cleveland, Ohio. And her business has been destroyed by the secondary effects of COVID-19. She understands why that has to be. But as she waits, she knows her skill set is unique. And so she writes this little sign that says, "Because I said I would." And she starts sewing face masks for the hospitals in her area, over 300 in 10 days, because she knows that everybody has to play a role in flattening the curve. Even our high school chapters of our charity, our students are wearing masks to show their peers that that is something we need to do to be a part of the solution. They're sewing masks. We even have chapters of our volunteers in prisons that make promises to help others in need who are currently fighting the good fight against the coronavirus. This is a picture of an inmate from Pendleton, Indiana. Minimum sentence is 12 years to life without parole. The person you're seeing in this picture will never see the light of freedom. but he made a promise to himself. In our program, he made a promise that he was going to be a part of bettering humanity, even if that meant inside those walls. So he puts on his "Because I Said I Would" wristband, and he goes to work. "Because I Said I Would" has received funding to sew over 100,000 face masks here regionally. But we've created a template, a tutorial video, where you could even sew a face mask and make that promise. Or maybe if you don't have that skill set, maybe you know someone who does. BecauseISaidIWould.org/masks. You can find out more information there. This Saturday, I took some time to deliver fabric to over 200 sewers we've got in signed up. And I just started delivering pre-cut fabric to them so they could get started. We've delivered fabric for 1,500 masks so far since Thursday of last week. And I believe we're slated to make deliveries for another 6,000 this week. I'm not a healthcare worker. I don't know how to sew, but I'm not going to let either of those things try to convince me that I can't be a part of a solution. And as much as we have done over the years in our volunteer projects, even our character education programs in schools and prisons, as the organization grew from just a small piece of paper into charitable impact much wider, you start to be invited to speak on stages. People, for better or worse, believe you're a thought leader. But that person who kept their promises, that person was my father. That's who I was talking about. But people assumed it was me, and so I had to adapt. I had to become what the world thought the founder of Because I Said I Would should be. And that's been a journey, because I guess what I'm trying to say is you have to know who I was before all of this even started. Before my father ever passed away, before I ever clicked that button, before everything went viral and spread around social media, before the Today Show, before Steve Harvey, before all that, I was just some dude, you know? I was just some guy working at a software company, which is pretty stereotypical for an Asian guy, you know? And yes, I know karate, but that's not the point. The point is that I really liked working at this software company. I'll be a little cocky for a second, and I apologize. But I was the youngest manager in an enterprise software company of over, you know, 1,400 employees. Fortune magazine, top 100 companies to work for in the United States. I made a six-figure income, five-figure bonuses, five-figure stock options, everything that my father came to this land for himself. His son had. But you get a bunch of messages from people who are requesting promise cards. Get a bunch of messages like that, and then you stare me right in the face and try to tell me that somehow this life is just about money. Nah. Money's only a means to an end. That end we must choose. So I thought maybe I should quit my job, start a nonprofit. Terrible, terrible idea. I would learn firsthand how difficult charitable work really is. But in the beginning, it didn't make any sense to leave my job because this was what was happening, okay? I was making all this money from the software company, and then I was spending tens of thousands of dollars of my paychecks on stamps and envelopes. Promise cards, mailing these things out because donations weren't coming in. Yet I had made a promise in memory of my father, and so I had to make sure they kept going out. So it didn't make any sense to leave my job, but one day I'd be pushed over the edge emotionally to leave my job because of this letter that was dropped at my desk at work, which is strange. Now, this letter was anonymous. Didn't know who it came from. Nobody's name on it but my own. This letter would convince me to leave my job. It would teach me a lesson about promises, and I would like to read part of it to you right now. It was February of 2013. I'm sitting at my desk at work, and I read, "Hi, Alex. I've been keeping up with your blog. Because I Said I Would has really, really helped me through a rough patch. There have been lots of times where I didn't think life was worth living, and I almost took my life. Almost. I'm getting stronger every day, and A lot of that strength comes from a few promise cards I've written. I have lots of people who care about me. I'm a very, very lucky person. It took a lot for me to realize that I should be alive. I do have a purpose. I'm not sure if I would even be around if it wasn't for you and your organization. So thanks, Mr. Sheen. I know I'm supposed to write this on a card, but I want to promise you that I will not give up. I think about this letter a lot right now because of those unemployment figures that keep coming out. Although it has nothing to do, it would seem, with the nature of this letter, remember that unemployment and suicide, that's not just a correlation. There's causation there. And I think about everybody who's having a real hard time right now with mental health challenges, doing their best to be a decent citizen and staying home, but it's not the same for everybody. It can be pretty rough. But flashback to this day, 2013, I'm sitting at my desk and I just cry, thinking about what my father might say about a promise like that, or if even he thought of promises like this. I stood up in this office in this sea of people and I wondered, you know, who is it? Is it a friend of mine who just didn't want me to know what they were going through, so they left their name off of it? Or is it a complete stranger? I mean, 1,400 people, you can't know them all. More importantly, this letter gave me the courage to do what I knew already had to be done. And that was to leave my life of comfort, to go alone and help people in what little ways I know how. And so I asked for a meeting with my boss. She didn't know what this meeting was about, but she agreed to it. And I remember walking into her office with this letter in hand. She was sitting there at her desk, you know, pretending to work or whatever bosses are doing all the time in there, you know. And I walk in and I give her this letter. I say, hey, boss, if you could just read this, you know, it would make it a lot easier for me to do what I got to do right now. And she says, sure, Alex, no problem. She unfolds this college ruled piece of notebook paper. She reads as much as I have literally just read to you right now. But then she stops. Like halfway through the letter, she just stops reading. She looks up at me and she says, Alex, this letter, Alex, this letter is from my daughter. This is about her, my boss says. This is her handwriting. That envelope you're holding, those are the kind of envelopes I have on my kitchen counter, Alex. When did she give this to you? You see, I didn't know this, but my boss's daughter had been suffering through depression. And with depression, I believe that time and support, reaching out for help, I believe there's a path to hope. That is what I believe. But at age 14, my boss's daughter did not yet share this thought. You see, she was overweight, and she'd go to school, and kids decided that they were going to pick on her for that. And so she'd come home in this feeling of rejection and sorrow, not knowing how to handle her emotions at such a young age, she would cut herself. But you see, this family, they knew about promise cards long before the world. And sometimes with our bad habits, in our darkest moments, maybe it's not about promising to quit forever. Because honestly, sometimes forever, it is too far to hold. But how about just write not today? And then do that again tomorrow. And see if we can get these things to stack up. My boss's daughter would end this habit of self-harm and she would write this letter. She'd ask an older student to drive her to the place where I worked, where her parents worked. With this letter in hand, she would sneak into our office like some kind of middle school ninja or something. I imagine her like a ninja get up, doing a bunch of cartwheels past security. She would put this letter in my inbox. It would get to my desk, and that's part of the reason I'm talking to you right now. I'm all in. And I'm asking you right now, I'm asking you to be a part of something in your own way, in your own life. We are a social movement, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the betterment of humanity through promises made and kept. That's how I believe this world is made better. When each and every one of us, on our shoulders and on our backs takes the burden of a promise to improve ourselves, our families, a community, a cause. It is a belief in the power of a single individual and the personal responsibility we should hold to shape this world into something better. And what time more than now? What time more than now shows us the importance of individual responsibility? That sometimes it comes down to each and every one of us to be a part of the solution. What time more than now highlights that? You tell me. I deeply believe that every promise is made of seven components. In one way or another, they are always there. In the millions of promise cards that I've seen in this life, tell me what self-control could mean to society right now. Tell me what compassion could mean to society right now. Tell me what we need to do to sacrifice to keep society right now. And as COVID-19 continues to affect the world, to affect your life, there are so many commitments that we could choose, so many paths we could go down, so many promises that we have yet to keep that have just been bombarded by the stress of the moment. And so I wanted to share with you in the millions of promise cards that I've seen, in the character development workshops, the leadership workshops that we do in schools and prisons, and all the research that we've done, three concepts that I think apply to this moment and how to keep promises when times are hard. The first thing I wanted to share with you is the concept, a concept called the courage of no. You know, you can't just make promises all the time. That's not what this movement is about. It's not a volume-based thought. It's about not just making promises, it's about keeping them. And sometimes you need to have the courage of no to keep your priorities. And I think that thought of courage is really highlighted by a study. Something that happened in 1951 called the Solomon Ash Study that put seven people into a room. Now, these seven people were told that they were going to participate in a vision test. That's all it was. You had to compare two sets of lines. Which comparison line is like the target line? In this case, it's clear. A. A is like the target line. That's all you had to do. One by one, they would answer in a row. And so they started with the test. Comparison one goes exactly as you imagine. B is the matching line. Everyone says B. Comparison two, C is just like the target line. One by one, they all say C. But something strange happens in the third comparison. The first person gets it wrong. Like, these people are pre-vetted to have decent vision, but they get it wrong? Well, okay. That's one person, but the second person gets it wrong too. Clearly, A is the right answer, but one after the other, in an order, they all say the wrong answer. What's going on here? Well, this study in 1951 by Solomon Ash isn't a study about vision at all. It's a study about conformity, because the first six people answering that question are all actors. The last person is the only person being tested here. Would they conform to other people saying an obviously wrong answer? Could their courage be diminished by that pressure? When there was no pressure, when there was no actors, and everybody was on an even playing field really doing the test, only 2% of people got the answer wrong. But when you introduced pressure from actors, 30-time increase, 30x increase in wrong answers. Human beings, by nature, we conform. But if we know that, if we know that our life is being consistently, constantly asked for commitment, and sometimes we just go with the flow, but then never end up keeping that promise. We say yes, but we never follow through just because we were tense in that moment when we were being asked. So we just blurt out, yes, I'll do it. Well, we're not doing anybody favors by making promises we never intend to keep. And so you have to have the courage of no to maintain priorities, understand our psychology so that we can keep a prioritization, because prioritization is the key to a purposeful life. In a personal example from my life, I once made a promise to 20 kids who've been diagnosed with cancer. I promised them 20 tickets to Disneyland, but then I surprised them with 100 tickets to Disneyland. This woman looks like I just punched someone in the face. I did not, but why am I bringing this up right now when it comes to Courage of No? As a part of a charity, as a leader, I'm constantly asked, well, I saw you did this charitable thing. Can you do that for my family? Can you do that for me? I'm sick. And of course I would want to help all of these people. But if I drain the reserves of because I said I went to zero, I would have, of course have to let all of our programming staff go and we would be left to non-existence. You have to make some pretty hard and difficult decisions in the life of charity, but we all have to do that day to day. Sometimes that means prioritization and the courage of no, which is unfortunate, but life is just not fair, and we have to do the best we can with what we've got. The second tip that I want to talk about on how to keep promises that have helped me beyond the courage of no is the thought of 100% calendaring. What is 100% calendaring? That means not just calendaring the meetings that you have in a given day, just the interactions with another person. That's usually how people use the calendar. I'm saying calendar everything. When I say everything, I mean like I calendar time to sleep. When someone says, oh, will you do this? And I make a promise. Even if it's an individual task, all those things, I'm not exaggerating with you. I literally calendar time to calendar. That's not a joke. And when we look at something like that, the thought of 100% filled calendar, it almost looks like stressful when you look at a calendar. When it's all full, like every block, ugh, it's like just looking at it, it's hard. But there are studies to show that this time management tactic actually decreases stress, not increase it. In a study published by the American Psychological Association, the best way to manage stress is time management. It proved to be a better habit than goals. List making, time management created less job tension, increased GPAs, and increased overall satisfaction with life. And I know what you're thinking when you're seeing these bullet points. Why does number one have a period at the end and so does number three, but number two doesn't? You know, OCD kicking in. Got to talk to my animators. No, that's not the point, obviously. It may seem counterintuitive, but all this calendaring, all this time management, all this, the tedious nature of it, actually turns out that time management is stress management. Because when you have a plan, you have more hope. When you have a plan, you have more confidence. When you have a filled calendar, all those anxious moments of, oh, I said I was going to do this. I said I was going to do that. I have to follow with this. All these moments that just pop up in your mind, you grab one of those and you stick it on your calendar and you don't worry about it until that moment comes along. And that way your mind can be free of that stress because the stress has a place to live and that place is on your calendar. I've made a lot of big promises in this life. In 2013, I walked 240 miles across the entire state of Ohio in 10 days for those three women from Cleveland who were held captive and abused for 10 years in Cleveland. If you remember that story about Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, and Michelle Knight, I raised funding for them so early on in their recovery. But if you make promises like this, it may seem all physical. It may seem like, you know, a marathon a day, and that's where your mind might go. But I'm telling you, I've spoken to a lot of people who have kept huge promises in this life, and maintaining time management and having a plan is sometimes harder and more important in some ways, maybe not harder, more important than the physical act itself. Okay, so those are two ways to help keep promises. What's a third? A third is having a code of honor. That might be obvious on what that means, but I want to highlight it with a fictitious scenario. Okay, it's something made up, but stick with me for a second. It'll eventually come around, hopefully. Okay, you, in this fictitious scenario, are walking in the woods. During stay-at-home orders, it's okay to do that, right? So I don't know. You're walking in the woods. Walking in the woods, and you all of a sudden hear this sound, like a buzzing electronic kind of sound. And it's coming from over there, and you start walking, and you see this glowing light, and so you push the bushes out of the way, and you see a large metal pod. a large metal pod with an engraving on it. So you wipe away the branches, the leaves, to read this engraving. And what it says is, people often see the past, how the past might have been better. You might have acted differently, said something different, and the subsequent events might have unfolded in a different way. Have you ever had one of these thoughts that was might have been especially vivid, compelling, or obvious to you, something you couldn't help but think about? And that thought crosses your mind, but then it's the next words that really grab you. The machine says it can take you back to that moment. And so your mind's racing, but as it does, the pod actually opens up. It opens up and you decide, you know what, I'm climbing in. So you buckle in, you think back to that moment of regret, that moment that you wish you could have taken back. You think back to that moment, you press that button. My question to you right now, in that moment of regret that you wish you could take back, where does this machine take you? That question was actually a verbatim question used in a university study to determine what people regretted the most. And I think about regret a lot, even in the loss of my father, the things I should have said to him as his son, the things I should have done for him. And I feel like in the decisions that I've made mistakes upon, the decisions that I make mistakes with, I just wish that I didn't make the decision, I guess, almost the way I made the decision, which was by impulse. I feel like that's a lot of the reasons we sometimes go off the rails. It's how we're making the decisions. Sometimes we make decisions just almost just purely off of our physical reaction, our emotional reaction to a minute. And that would be like going to a court of law and the judge has three people in front of him. They've all committed the same exact crime. And he says, 5-day sentence for you, 15-day sentence for you, 50 years for you. It would be ludicrous for us not to have a set of rules, of laws, to more evenly distribute justice, evenly distribute the way we make these decisions. And that sometimes I feel is how we make decisions. I believe that every person should create a code of honor, core values, you can call them whatever you want, but not let them just be some kind of plaque on a wall. I'm really tired of people saying this so often, even at conferences and leadership sessions. Like, I'm saying you have to have it literally memorized. What are your three things? What are your five things? And every time you come to a moment in this life where you're not sure what to do, you run that dilemma through this filter, through your code of honor. You know, I know what mine is. Compassion, contemplation, accountability, sacrifice, self-control, honesty, hope. When I come to a moment, I say, okay, well, what would be the compassionate thing? Okay, well, how does that balance with hope? And I have a framework to make a better decision with. So in those bigger commitments in life, I can stay on a path, because that's, I guess, at the end of the day, what I'm trying to do the most is to adhere to a code of honor. And all my promises are just born out of that. So having a code of honor, I think, is huge to keeping promises, especially when times are uncertain and so many new things are thrown at us. We've got to make a lot of new decisions. And those are some of my thoughts on how to keep promises in this moment. Have the courage of no, so you're making and keeping your promises, that you have the bandwidth to do what you said you're going to do. Try to relieve some stress with 100% calendaring. Try for 3 days. Don't do it forever. Maybe it's not 100%. Maybe it's 80%. Give it a go, but try for the next 3 days. And then a code of honor. What do you use to make your decisions with? If you're interested in learning more about habits and tactics to keep your promises, please know that Because I Said It as a charity makes most of its content, like basically everything, available for free. And in this time where we're at home isolated with our families, it's a unique opportunity to help build character in our nieces, nephews, our children, grandchildren. And so you can check out our videos, our family isolation activities, our entire animated series, some of the clips I showed are a part of that because I said I would .org/COVID-19. And then if you go to family isolation activities, there's discussion questions after the videos, things that can help you not only bond with your family, but build a strength of self-control that we all need. If you're looking to take an extra step and not just learn the habits and tactics to keep promises, if you want to take an action to fight against COVID-19 with us, I encourage you to visit that same link, because I said I would .org/COVID-19, and click on individual action plans. These are promises that you can make right now, like sewing masks, like helping seniors learn grocery apps so they reduce their exposure to the virus. There's a lot of different things that you can do, and these are available to anybody around the world at our website. We want to do our best to help flatten that curve, and that can come in different ways. My name is Alex Sheen, and I'm the founder of Because I Said I Would. To me, it's an honor to share with you how this card was born in my life, what it means to me, what we're doing right now, and just a little bit about where this whole thing is going. It's a very confusing time in life, and I often, in those moments, want to speak to my dad. Gain an ounce of wisdom from him on what I might do at this time. And as he worked in a hospital for 25 years, let's say in some other universe he would have survived. His lungs would have still been shot, his immune system compromised. I have this weird feeling that he still would have went to work to help save other people. He went to work with his immune system compromised. They had to say, Al, you can't come here anymore, you know? You got to go home and rest. Well, my dad can't make that impact anymore, so I'm going to try to fill his shoes as best I can. And if you ever feel a sense of hopelessness, that perhaps you don't have the skills or resources to make a difference right now, I ask you to reflect on this quote from Calvin Coolidge. Nothing in this world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistent and determination alone are omnipotent. They have always solved the challenges of the human race. I hope only the best for you, your family, and the journey of life right now. Fight the good fight, okay?
Thanks so much, Alex. You know, when I heard you talk a few months ago, I knew that we had to have you on Spartan Pro Show. It's interesting. You had your all-in slide, and I just wrote that here. Alex, you don't even know that, but my mom's name is Nilla, and she died Christmas Day of 2014 from cancer, and that's all-in backwards is Nilla. And it when I heard how you've continued to honor your word, how you've honored the legacy that your dad left, when he died, and the emotions that you still carry with you today, it's just, it really connects with me, and it just shows me how much your dad impressed on you and how valuable his impact has been on you, which shows me how valuable my impact can be on my kids, on my siblings, on my friends, on my employees. And that's how my mom lived too. Was honoring her word and going and doing crazy things, like hosting you on our pro show, right? I mean, this is just what an honor to have you on here. And what I'd like to ask for, just a couple questions here that kind of can give me some context, can give some of the listeners and attendees context. So sure. I want to go back real quick to your comment about the unemployment rate. I mean, yeah, we haven't gotten the newest numbers, but over 22 million people in a month that mm-hmm. aren't employed anymore. And so you shared some good framework there. Is there any other ways that we can just love people around us? Anything else that, obviously we have no framework or context for 22 million people in 4 weeks being unemployed. But certainly the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, I guess, has gotten three times the number of calls that they normally would get. Any other context you want to share of how we can just love on people and help them?
Yeah. You know, I know that people keep saying this, and it reminds me, so I'm going to say some things you probably already heard, but realize that, you know, talk is cheap. People say a lot of things, and it's not about saying it. It's whether or not it's being done. People say, you know, check on your friends and family, right? Call them. I'm not coming really with a lot of new solutions. I'm just saying, let's do what we know we need to do, if that makes sense. And so one of our individual action plans that's not shared here, but is on this page, because I said I would .org/COVID-19, is how to be an accountability partner for somebody during this time. Someone who you know for a fact has a mental health challenge. Don't pretend like people are coming out of the woodwork to help that person. Right now, we've got something happening called the bystander effect. And for those who are familiar, bystander effect just means that, it's highlighted by example. Okay, someone's broke down on the side of the road on the highway, right? You pass by and you're like, I hope that person gets help. Somebody's going to probably help them, right? And you pass and another car passes and literally 500 cars pass thinking the same exact thing, right? Which is human, it's human nature. So don't feel bad about that necessarily. But that's the bystander effect, thinking that somebody else is going to do it. And you might be thinking about that with elderly or senior citizens in your family, that somebody else must be helping them a little. No. A lot of times in this life, if you don't do it, no one else will. So I encourage you to go to becauseisaidit.org/COVID-19, helping lonely seniors, self-care during social isolation, distancing. We've got, I believe, 10 up there right now, individual action plans. And then we've got 8 more in development. Right now, this is going to be a long haul in certain ways, and so thank you for highlighting that, because yes, you're absolutely right. Unprecedented unemployment rate is definitely part of our moment, and there's going to be a lot of people to help out there. As far as being a charity ourselves, it's a shame, because I'm talking to some of our peers, right? Some of the folks who run other nonprofits. I remember I got this text. This is literally like right when we started staying home. She said, Alex, I had 62 employees at the charity. I had to pray one after the other, 60 of them, and let them go. You know, there's the charities that usually help people through moments like this. A lot of them will not exist by the time this is over. And so, David, thank you again for asking that and just pushing people towards taking that responsibility on themselves in small ways. So I think that's something we need to do.
And so, Alex, you know, you mentioned other nonprofits that you're connected with, and 100% of your speaking fees go directly towards your cause. So, you know, how is COVID-19, how has everything that's happened impacted your organization, and what are you doing to pivot during these challenging times?
Yeah. I've lost it all. I've made $1 million a year just speaking fees. No books, nothing else, just speaking. And all of those canceled. But my dad used to say to me, Alex, the only person in this world you can control is yourself.
Sorry, Alex, it cut out about 10 seconds ago. Say that again.
Yeah. Yeah, no worries. I make about $1 million a year giving speeches, and 100% of that goes to the charity, as you mentioned. And, you know, this is not a small, I mean, it's small in the grand scheme of things, but, you know, I've got 14 employees, 14 families to feed, to help. They run all this program in the prisons and the schools, the character education, the volunteer projects, masks, all the things that we're doing. I've got to make $100,000 a month to meet payroll and expenses, and just entirely wiped away. I mean, my average speaking audience is 850 people. It's going to be a real long time before I'm ever able to do again what I do. But like I said, my dad used to say to me, Alex, the only person in this world you can control is yourself. So let's start there. I'm not going to just wallow in loss. There's literally, I don't have time for that. And I remember back in 2013 when the charity was just starting and I was really struggling financially. I was down to my last 9 days of payroll, my last 9 days. I have brought this organization back from asunder and I will do it again. The charitable work that we do is going to be too important in the future to give up now. The unemployment rate, like you said, has skyrocketed. More people will need to make that promise that I will not kill myself. And they'll need the support of programming. You know, kids are struggling a lot right now, but they've got an energy to help. And we've got these chapters of volunteers. What, I'm just going to give up on that? I will not accept that as an answer. So do I have some hard decisions in front of me? Absolutely. But because of our generosity of our supporters, we just ran a 30-day campaign that raised $81,000. What does that do? That positions us to keep trucking. Now, it may be a month-by-month type of operation because, you know, we're slowly eating into reserves, but you need hope to make a promise. Without hope, you never even try. I've told that to people every day since my father died, and I'm not about to be a hypocrite and not buy my own belief. Now, I don't have to be naive. I do have to be realistic. That's part of being keeping promises too. But there's going to be so many people to help out there. And so I got to stick around. That's what we're trying to do.
That's powerful. And for those of you who are watching or listening, that we dove in and about 30 or 40 days ago, we got that message that, you know, most of because I said I would speaking engagements, Alex's speaking engagements were canceled. We decided to make a donation because we believe that this is an incredible cause and supporting communities around. So we're going to ask you directly. I'm just making a plea, making a beg and an ask for you to go to becauseisaidiwould.org/donate and make a donation, a small donation, big donation, recurring or one time, something to help them stay afloat, not only for those 14 families. I know you're struggling yourself too. If you're not and you're able to pivot, great. You're in a great cash flow position to help them out. But if you are struggling, this is a great community and they are helping people not take their own lives. They're helping people completely change their lives, their family trees. And so I implore you to reach out and make a donation there. Again, becauseisaidiwould.org/donate. Alex, one thing that I want to ask here too is with the COVID-19. So real quickly, we're talking about people losing their jobs. We're also talking about people completely losing their businesses, right? You mentioned a nonprofit that practically had to shut down and for-profits as well. And so where are you finding the balance? So I'm hearing, I don't know if it's 50-50, but I'm hearing a big swath of my friends saying we have to stay home to flatten the curve because people are going to die. And I'm also hearing a whole swath of my friends and business owners and clients who are saying, if we stay home, I'm going to lose everything I've ever had financially. I'm going to have to get foreclosed on. I'm going to file bankruptcy next week. And then I'm going to fire my employees and then people are going to take their lives. And so where can we find that balance?
Yes. You know, I want to pull up a slide that I think speaks to this at least in one way. So this is seven elements of honor. And this is actually what our character development programming in schools and prisons, we do character development workshops with students and inmates to teach them the habits and tactics on these seven issues, right? And I went over a couple of tips today, but number five is something that I think society is struggling with right now. Maybe it's because of the advance of technology. Maybe it's a cultural shift. Maybe it's a lot of things. But we're so used to just everything being a click of a button. Everything next day, delivery, right? Everything is immediate. Everything has a solution of artificial intelligence or robotics or software can do it. Or that we've almost culturally lost this context that sometimes life just requires sacrifice, that there is no easy way out. And while I will not pretend to be an economist, I will not pretend to be an epidemiologist, I won't pretend to be a lot of any of those things. What I do know is that there is no easy answer. And my mom used to say to me, mom and dad were very different, but she used to say to me, Alex, whoever told you life was fair lied to you. And I don't know why that just keeps ringing in my head right now, because if we just open back up the economy, people are going to get sick at a rate that is going to create not only an amount of – it's not like if you just open it up, everyone's going to go out there and do business anyway. And then two, if you overwhelm the healthcare system, you'll create a new level of fear that we don't even know what that feels like yet. Did you know that in Liberia during the Ebola epidemic, which killed less people than coronavirus, to my knowledge, that hospital workers, doctors, and nurses, once it got so bad, just stopped going to work? Then every hospital system in the whole country closed down? That is an effect. Like, healthcare workers right now are not sure. I just spoke to the Mayo Clinic. I've spoke to the Mayo Clinic multiple times. I spoke to the American Academy of Physician Assistants. I've spoken to the American Association of Critical Care Nurses. I've spoken to American Pharmacists Association. I know these people, and I've been talking to them recently. There's a point where if you break this system down far enough, people break down themselves. And so do I know that's going to happen? No. Again, what do I know? I don't know much. I know how to keep promises. But what I do know is that sacrifice and hardship is a part of life. So just having it one way or the other, I don't think is possible. But I don't think we can expect a good solution. We can just expect the best solution we can have and try to follow math and science, both economics and epidemiology and health. But sacrifices are going to have to be made. And I just hate saying that, because as a humanitarian working in a nonprofit, that's the last thing you want to admit. That's the last thing you want to believe. But this is just going to be real tough. And as someone working in mental health, or at least with those with mental health challenges, I know I've looked at the suicide rates during the Great Depression. I've read the report from the United States Department of Veteran Affairs about the correlation of mass layoffs and suicidal tendencies. There is real cause and effect research to show hardships that closing the economy creates. So I don't want to downplay that. I also know that, full 747s, full 747 of people are basically crashing into the ground of New York City every single day still. That, and so that's where these hard choices comes in. That's where courage comes in. That's where our leaders are going to have to make some tough choices. So what do I got to do? What do you got to do? We've got to do the best we can with what's around us and try to make the most humanitarian choices, to make some sacrifices and accept that as part of life. And it's easier said than done, but we're in a hard spot, and we just have to swallow that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's make a real quick transition to our final rundown. It's a little bit of a lighter topic just to wrap this up, but
please, David.
Yes. Yes. I know it's tough, but it's the important stuff, right? I mean, it's valuable for people to hear you and I talk about the things that people don't want to talk about and the uncomfortable stuff. But yes, let's take it down to kind of a personal, but slightly lighthearted, more lighthearted topic. So can you share what's one of the most impactful books or resources that you have read?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I like that. I like that question. There is a series called Great Courses, and they're collegiate courses, lecture series, that are just audiobooks. So I'm really into audiobooks. Usually I travel like 300 days a year. Obviously I'm not doing any of that now, but audiobooks in the line at the airport, waiting to take off and stuff like that help me be productive. So the Great Courses has one called Your Deceptive Mind. I believe it's a professor from Smith College. This lecture series just talks about really the concept of logical fallacies, things that seem to make sense by intuition, by human intuition, like our knee-jerk reaction, oh, that makes sense, but actually aren't true at all. And I think that plays out a lot in charity. I think that plays out a lot in the challenges we're seeing in understanding, interpreting the truth of information. Let me give an example of that. Like David, or two Davids, my middle name is David, by the way. So we've got like a service of Davids here. I think that's the Greek character. I can't remember. Anyways, so have you remember DARE program? The DARE program, yeah. Like don't do drugs, kind of thing, right?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, seems good. Officers coming in, great, blah, blah, blah. Okay, when researched, the DARE program, in comparison to a school without a DARE program, shows absolutely no difference in teen drug use. Okay? So logically, you would say, well, doing something is better than nothing. No, that is actually not true. That is sometimes not true. Okay, I'm going to look at even the picture I'm showing right now. Okay, I mentioned this man is serving life in prison. Okay, right? So one of the things, what do they do with kids who are at risk, you know, not behaving properly? Like they've got that scared straight program, right? Scared straight. Bring them to prison. Everybody yells at them, oh, God, I don't want to be there. So then, you know, scare them straight, whatever that. Okay. Go to the United States Department of Justice website, and there will literally be a statement that says, do not do this. This has proven to increase violent activity in teenagers 26%. Don't anybody do this. It seems like it makes sense, but not everything that seems like it makes sense actually does. So Your Deceptive Mind, The Great Courses, that's something that really just opened my eyes to interpreting a lot of things to help understand the truth, understand impact. Is what I'm doing actually making a difference? I think families feel that way a lot of times. You know, parents, you know, you yell at your kid and you have like a good intent. I'm yelling at them. I'm trying to, you know, get them in line. But that could actually send them on the opposite direction. We all have seen those parenting challenges. So it just applies to everything we do. It's just really thought-provoking. And I think it's probably like a five-hour program. And it'll keep you on the edge of your seat.
That's great. So you talked a lot about personal advice that you got from your father, from your parents, both. What's some of the best professional advice you've ever received?
HR is number one, you know, especially in charity. You know, you're an organization made out of people. And if you don't take care of your people, your organization's not going to be very good. Now, I'll be the first to say that I suck at HR stuff. I'm very performance driven and 100% calendar and follow the policy and rules and why isn't this done? I kind of suck as a manager, to be honest. I'm a little bit too robotic, and I've seen that shortfall play out many times as an executive leader. You know, I want promises to be kept, but who makes those promises? Human beings, you know. And so I got to get a lot better at that side of the ball. But yeah, HR is who you select, who you keep. That's going to change the direction of your charity for sure. It's going to determine how much impact you make. So whether you like it or not, or you don't, you know, all these policies or, you know, discussions and feelings and stuff like that, you know, whether you do well with them or not, it just kind of doesn't matter. You've got to get good. And so, yeah, that's what I'd have to say.
So if we pivoted the opposite direction, do you have any worst advice that you've received professionally that you just said, I don't want that tool anywhere near my tool shed?
Yeah. I'm a gambler, like almost literally, right? Like Asian families, or at least my family, gambled a little bit more. Like we'd play for quarters or something smaller. It's more normal from where my family is from. But in American culture, you'd say, oh, there's some gamblers. And to, of course, a healthy and a degree with limits. But my point in saying that is just like risk mitigation and being cautious, I just have never seen that work for me. Not never, that's an exaggeration. Of course, you need to mitigate risks. I don't want to exaggerate. but I've got a lot of advice that says that that's not possible. Mm. I've got a lot of perspectives saying that, you know, you should draw it back, Alex, draw it back. You know, you're pushing the edge of how much money you're sending out in this charitable way through these programs and the overhead that comes with running the programs. If you realize you're making all of this money, you could just run this whole thing with like two or three people. Mm. Like you literally could run it by yourself and probably make 600 grand, you know? Why don't you just do that? Because then you'll solidify the safety, the foundation of this organization, have impenetrable reserves. And to that, I would say, well, what about all these people we're supposed to help? This isn't about my safety or the legacy of an organization to microscopically exist. Read these promise stories. Talk to these inmates. These kids live in 100% in a community where 100% of the people make under the federal poverty line. They need support and help. This person who's writing to us says they want to kill themselves today. And I'm going to sit to help the job security of my employees and not put out programming and resources for these people. I cannot do that. Right. And that's one of the challenges that comes with an organization like ours. We have to value the cause and the impact more than even our own job security and financial reserves. So yeah, I had $250,000 in reserves because I'm not a fly-by-night operations. Our donors wouldn't want that either. But you can't just keep $500,000 or $1 million in there and not use that money to help people when they are so desperately in need. So I would say the advice that I would ignore is you know, sometimes you've got to take risks so long as they're calculated. Right. When I say I'm going to do something, I put out a plan. I do the math of how we're going to get there. If that plan makes sense to me, we're doing it.
So big visions are okay. Don't be driven by fear. Don't hide from a vision of solving a problem or helping a person just because it might not work.
Yeah. You know, there's a phrase I've heard before. It was used in a political context. Please don't take it that way. We are a nonpartisan organization, but there was a phrase out there. People said, hope is not a plan. Right. And I do agree with like that in the principle of like organizing an impact of a charity. You know, you want to have hope to keep you going. The hope isn't a plan. You've got to write it down and do the math of whether or not this can actually work. That to me is true vision, a plan. I don't even maybe like the word vision as much because, you know, there's so vision statements, mission this and blah, blah, blah. You know, I just like literally show me the plan, like the business plan of what's going to happen. And if that makes sense, then that's really how I measure risk. Because if I look at a good plan and it says we're going to go from $0 of fundraising to 100,000 in 30 days, without that plan, that sounds ridiculous. With the plan, I don't see risk. I see a plan that this is possible. So anyways.
I love it. Well, thanks so much, Alex. So we'll wrap up there. Just a reminder for our listeners, Spartan Pro Day, we've got coming up October 13th. Visit SpartanProDay.com to access that. And we'll be sending out intro information on that soon. And also, please, that link down below, becauseisaidiwould.org/donate. Please go on there and help support them. Alex is doing great work. His team is absolutely crushing it. They're just serving, and they need you to get their backs and cover them. All right. Thanks, folks. Have a good one.
Thanks, everyone.